to put spunk in Danny's swagger. Corinne sighed convincingly when Danny showed her the Jaguar XJ12 parked in the garage. She gasped when he opened a dresser drawer and showed her his golden watch and his royal cufflinks. Corinne looked at him starry-eyed as they stood in the entrance hall saying goodbye. She told him she adored his castle and that he was a very handsome and sexy Prince Charming. Then the front door opened, and Jim Williams walked in.
"Hey, sport," Williams said. He was in a cheery mood.
"We was just leaving," Danny mumbled.
"What's your hurry? Stay for a drink. Introduce me to your pretty friend."
"We already had a drink," said Danny.
His mood had turned sullen.
"Well, it won't hurt you to stick around a few minutes and be sociable," Williams replied amiably. "There's always time for that."
Williams introduced himself to Corinne, and then walked into the living room with an air of such self-assurance that Danny and Corinne followed as if summoned by decree. Corinne told Williams she was a student at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Williams responded by telling several gossipy tales about various members of the SCAD faculty, much to Corinne's amusement. Danny sat on the edge of his chair, glowering. Williams lit up a King Edward cigarillo.
"I assume Danny has taken you on a tour of the house," he said. "Did he show you how to play psycho dice?"
"No?
Ah, then allow me."
He took Corinne over to the backgammon table and sat her down. He explained the rules of the game and said that by concentrating on the dice, a person could improve the odds. He told Corinne about the scientists at Duke University and how their experiment had proved that if you really focused your mental energy, you could make things happen, in dice or in just about anything. He glanced over at Danny, who was still sitting glumly in his chair.
"Now see, for example," Williams said slyly, "if we both put our minds to it, I mean really concentrate, we can probably get Danny to get up out of that chair and make himself useful by fixing us a drink."
Danny got up wordlessly and left the room. Moments later, the front door slammed with a house-shaking wallop. Corinne jumped in her seat. Williams hardly flinched. He arched his eyebrows and smiled a bemused smile.
"I guess the message was received," he said, and returned to sender.
He shook the dice and tossed them onto the green felt board. Half an hour later, after having had a drink with Williams and played a few rounds of psycho dice, Corinne left Mercer House. Danny was standing by the curb, leaning against the fender of his black Camaro, his arms folded across his chest. Without taking his eyes off her, he reached down and opened the passenger door. "Get in," he said. It was late afternoon. Corinne had errands to do and plans for later on. She glanced at Danny's jeans, his t-shirt, his arms, and the smile that was beginning to creep across his face, and she got into the car. Danny made a ceremony of holding the door open and closing it politely. He walked around and got in. Corinne patted his arm.
"Okay, sport," she said. "Now maybe you can tell me why you left in such a hurry."
Danny shrugged.
"I don't like nobody making moves on a girl I'm with."
"Is that what you think Jim Williams was doing?"
"Yeah, and I don't go for that fucking shit."
"Let me tell you something," said Corinne. "I'm pretty good at knowing when somebody's making a pass at me. Jim Williams was not making a pass."
"He was being a wise ass."
"He was letting you know who's boss," she said.
Danny turned the key in the ignition.
"Same difference. And like I said, I don't dig that shit."
He threw the car into gear and floored the accelerator. The car shot out from the curb with an ear-piercing squeal.
Corinne grabbed the dashboard to brace herself. "Jesus Christ," she said. Danny swung around the corner of the square. A cloud of bluish-white smoke hung over the street in front of Mercer House.
"Buckle up," Danny shouted. "You're gonna have the ride of your life."
"No, I'm not," Corinne answered. "Let me out. Now."
"Later,"
he said.
"And don't worry, I ain't gonna kill you. I'm a great driver, and this is the hottest damn car on the road. This baby is supercharged."
Danny was smiling triumphantly. His eyes were bright. His self-confidence had returned. If he wasn't exactly the master of Mercer House, at least he was king of the road. Corinne breathed a sigh of resignation and settled back for the ride.
"Okay," she said. "Where are we going?"
"Out to Tybee," he said. "I want to show you something neat."
They sped east on the Islands Expressway toward the beach. Corinne looked at Danny, sizing him up. She preferred this cocky mood over the sullen one.
"So tell me, what's your connection to Mercer House and Jim Williams?" she asked.
"I work for him," he said, "when I feel like it. Odd jobs and shit."
"Well, that sounds more like it," she said. "You didn't strike me as the stately Holmes type."
"I make good money, don't you worry. And if anybody hassles me, I'm gone, man. I don't take any shit."
"So I noticed."
"Yeah. Hey, I almost knocked that door off its hinges when I hauled ass, didn't I? I bet Jim was pissed."
"I wouldn't say that," said Corinne. "I think he got a charge out of it, which I thought was a little weird."
The bridge to Tybee Island lay up ahead. Danny suddenly gunned the engine and picked up a burst of speed. He swooped around the car ahead of him, leaving an open stretch of roadway to the bridge.
"Hang on now," he said. "This is where we really take off."
The car accelerated like a rocket. With a thump, it hit a swayback bump in the road, and all four wheels lifted off the ground.
"Airborne!" Danny howled.
"Jesus Christ," Corinne muttered as the car bounced back onto the road. "Is that what you brought me out here for?"
"Yeah, neat, huh?" said Danny.
Corinne brushed the hair out of her face. "I need another drink." They continued on to the DeSoto Beach Hotel, a somewhat seedy oceanfront motel that was popular with the young crowd. It had an open-air lounge with a pool, a rock band, and a tropical-style bar with a straw hut roof. They ordered piña coladas and sat on the seawall to watch the surf and the people strolling on the beach. Within minutes, two good-looking young men came over, friends of Corinne's, fellow students at the Savannah College of Art and Design. While they talked, Danny remained silent. He became increasingly restive. He looked up the beach, down the beach. He fidgeted. He sighed. As soon as Corinne's friends said goodbye and walked away, he stood up.
"I got an idea," he said. "Bring your drink. We're going back into town."
That was fine with Corinne. She had things to do anyway.
"You're not planning to fly over that bump again, I hope," she said.
"Nah. It only works in one direction."
They got into the car and roared out of the parking lot, leaving a billowing backblast of gravel and dust.
"Did I detect a teeny bit of jealousy back there?" Corinne asked.
"No, uh-uh."
"You didn't think they were making moves on me, did you?"
"They were a couple of assholes is what they were."
Corinne didn't answer. She was comparing Danny with her two friends. The other two were more clean-cut than Danny, and better educated, too. Their families had money, and their futures were pretty much assured.
Those two were probably not unlike the man she would eventually marry, whoever that might be. But neither one of them had a fraction of Danny's sex appeal. She looked at the Confederate flag tattoo on his arm, at his flat stomach, at the way he gripped the wheel with one hand and rested the other lightly on his upper thigh. He looked back at her and smiled.
"Hey," he said softly. "You know what? On the way back to town, I'm going to take you to the most beautiful place in Savannah. It's my favorite place to get high in the whole world."
He turned off Victory Drive and drove down a winding road through the gates of Bonaventure Cemetery. The late afternoon sun filtered through the trees and cast soft, lengthening shadows. They walked down an avenue of oaks, smoking a joint.
"Dreamy, isn't it?" said Corinne.
"Yeah,"
said Danny.
"What do you think about when you come here?" she asked.
"Dying," he said. She laughed.
"I mean, besides that."
"Being dead."
"That's horrible," she said. "No, come on, really."
"I told you. I think about dying and being dead."
"What do you think about?"
"I think how peaceful it is. I think what a wonderful place this is to come to and escape from everything. To just cool out and relax and enjoy the serenity. But I never think about dead people. Looking at these old graves makes me think how generation after generation of the same family are all gathered together. And that makes me think about how life goes on, but not about dying. I never think about dying."
"Well, I do," said Danny. "I haven't think about what kind of grave I'm going to be buried in. Like, see them big old tombstones over there? They belong to rich people. And see them other ones there, the little ones? Those are for poor people. If I die in Mercer House, I'll get to have one of the big ones."
"What a creepy thing to say."
"Jim Williams is rich," said Danny. "He'd buy me a big tombstone."
There was nothing joking or boastful in Danny's voice. He was simply speaking his mind.
"But you're not getting ready to die, are you?"
"Why not? Ain't got nothing to live for."
"Everybody has something to live for," she said.
"Not if they're fucked up like me."
Corinne sat down on the moss-encrusted pedestal of a tall obelisk. She took Danny's hand and pulled him toward her. He sat down next to her.
"We all have problems," she said, "but we don't go around bumming people out talking about dying."
"I'm different," said Danny. "I've been on the street since I was 15. I quit school in the 8th grade. My family hates me. Bonnie, my girlfriend, won't marry me because I ain't got a full-time job."
"So you'd rather be dead, huh?"
Danny looked down at his feet and shrugged.
"Maybe."
"Well, look at it this way. If you had died last night, you wouldn't have met me this afternoon, right? And we wouldn't have fucked on that four-poster bed the way we did. That was something to live for, wasn't it?"
Danny took a long drag on the joint and handed it to her. She was sitting on the side of him that had the Confederate flag tattoo. He leaned against her and uttered a low growl.
"Well, was it?" she asked.
"Yeah, it was worth living for," he said. "But only if there's more where it came from."
He slid his arm around her waist and kissed the back of her neck, growling softly and nibbling at her like a playful lion cub. She felt a tingle of pleasure. In a moment, he was stroking her knee, rubbing her thigh, lifting her off the pedestal and lowering her onto the ground. She squealed as he rolled on top of her. He lay lightly on her, supporting himself by his elbows to keep from pressing her too hard against the ground.
Dried leaves crackled beneath them. She began to moan, louder and louder. Suddenly, he clapped his hand over her mouth and froze, motionless. Startled, she looked up and saw that he had lifted his head. He was peering out through the bushes. She could feel his heart pounding. He lay absolutely still, not moving a muscle. She heard voices. People were approaching. She turned her head and saw several pairs of legs walking along a path that would bring them to within a few feet of where they lay. She and Danny were only partly covered by the bushes. If the people looked in their direction as they passed, they would surely see them. She heard a middle-aged woman speaking in a complaining voice.
"Perpetual care means just what it says. It means taking care of things in perpetuity, like pulling out weeds and sweeping up debris forever. I'm going to stop at the guardhouse and have a word with the groundskeeper before we leave."
They were 20 feet away now, and coming closer. A man's voice replied,
"They do a pretty fair job compared to most places. Anyhow, I can't imagine Granny minds a few weeds or a couple of twigs lying around."
"Well, I do mind," the woman persisted. "And I want to know that when I'm laid to rest, someone will tend the plot in perpetuity, as they've been paid to do."
The legs were walking right by them now. Corinne held her breath.
"Suit yourself," said the man. "We'll wait for you in the car."
They had passed. They hadn't noticed. Danny relaxed his grip on Corinne's mouth and resumed having sex as easily as if he were picking up a conversation dropped in mid-sentence. Corinne was swept away by his staying power, and by his ability throughout the entire terrifying interruption to maintain a rock-hard erection. On the way back to the car, he walked with a spring in his step. Corinne took his hand in hers. She had rescued him from morbid thoughts, and that pleased her. He was moody, all right, but what did that matter? She had found the perfect sexual playmate. He was aglow, and she was aglow. But for very different reasons, as she discovered when he turned to her in the car and asked, "Will you marry me?" She wasn't so much taken aback as surprised at the absurdity of it.
"But we just met 3 hours ago," she said.
She started to laugh, but she realized almost at once, when she saw his expression suddenly turn grim, that his offer had been heartfelt. She had wounded him.
"You're going to marry one of them two assholes at the beach, aren't you?" he said softly.
"No," she said. "I don't know them well enough either."
"Sure you do. They got money. They got an education. What else do you need to know?"
She had hurt him deeply, and she was crushed. She was touched that he was so desperate to be loved.
"I had a wonderful time today," she said gently. "I really did. I..."
"But you won't marry me. You'll never marry me."
She struggled for words.
"Well, but I certainly want to see you again. I mean, we can get together often, and, you know, we can..."
She didn't see the back of his hand coming at her until it struck her a glancing blow on the cheek. It would have landed with more force, but Danny had floored the accelerator at the same moment and swung sharply onto Abercorn Street, throwing her against the door and out of reach. They roared south on Abercorn, swerving from lane to lane, passing one car after another. It was getting dark. Corinne cowered as far away from him as she could get. Her cheek felt numb.
"Please take me home," she pleaded.
"When I'm goddamn good and ready," he snapped.
they sped south. 2 miles, 3 miles, 5 miles. They sailed past the mall, past Armstrong State College. Corinne felt dizzy. She could think only of Danny's death wish, and that now he'd kill them both. Surely the vodka, the piña coladas, and the marijuana had taken their toll. He'd drive off the road. He'd slam into another car. She was frightened just looking at him. He was so utterly changed. His jaw was set. A diabolical fire lit his eyes. He held the wheel in a ferocious grip. It all seemed like a horrible, surreal nightmare. Suddenly, his image began to flicker before her eyes. The back of his head, his shoulders, his arms, his face, his whole body, as if caught in the beam of a stroboscopic light. She was about to lose consciousness when she heard sirens. It was the police. The rage drained out of Danny as quickly as it had flared up. He lifted his foot off the gas and pulled over onto the shoulder. 3 squad cars quickly hemmed him in, blue lights flashing. The crackle of 2-way radios filled the air. The policeman shouted at Danny and ordered him out of the car. He turned imploringly to Corinne, his face once again sweet, his voice childlike. "Get me out of this, will you?" They didn't see each other again after that. Corinne was still shaken by their encounter months later when she told me about it in Clary's drugstore. She'd made mistakes before, she said, and she'd make them again. But not like this, she hoped. She'd watched Danny from afar for months, studied him, worshipped him, stalked him. In all that time, it never entered her mind that he might turn out to be so volatile. She had thought of him only as a walking streak of sex, and about that, at least, she hadn't been wrong. Chapter 10. It ain't bragging if you're really done it. On the whole, the 30-odd residents of Monterey Square regarded their neighbor Jim Williams with a respectful friendliness. Several were on his Christmas party invitation list. Others were more wary and kept their distance. Virginia Duncan, who lived with her husband in a townhouse on Taylor Street, for example, still remembered the chill she felt when she came out of her house 2 years ago and saw the swastika hanging from Williams's window. John C. LeBay, a retired architect, had fought a number of acrimonious battles with Williams, all concerning what Williams described as LeBay's destructive incompetence in matters of architecture and historic preservation. So Mr. LeBay had no use for Jim Williams. But the LeBay-Williams feud was a mere quibble compared with the Cold War that raged between Williams and his next-door neighbors, Lee and Emma Adler. The Adlers lived in an elegant double townhouse that occupied the other side of the 2 trust lots on the west side of Monterey Square. Their side windows looked directly across Wayne Street at Williams's parlor and the ballroom above. It was the Adlers' howling dog that had prompted Williams to play his thunderous version of César Franck's Pièce Héroïque on the organ. But the dog's bark was only one sour note in a whole medley of bitterness that existed between the 2 households. Lee Adler, like Jim Williams, had played a central role in the restoration of Savannah's historic downtown. His approach was entirely different, however. While Williams' efforts had involved his own restoration of houses, Adler had been an organizer and fundraiser who left the actual restoration work to others. Adler had helped create a revolving fund for the purpose of buying old houses that were in imminent danger of being razed. The houses were then sold as soon as possible to people who promised to restore them properly.
Lee Adler's accomplishments had been so successful and his participation so energetic that he had emerged as a national spokesman for revolving funds and historic preservation. In recent years, he had turned his attention to renovating old houses for poor blacks. He toured the country making speeches. He was elected to the board of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. He lunched at the White House. His name appeared frequently in the New York Times and in national magazines. Now in his mid-50s, Lee Adler was probably the best-known Savannian outside Savannah. Lee Adler's national prominence inspired a fair amount of resentment in Savannah. It was widely felt, in Savannah at least, that Adler's manner was bombastic and peremptory, that he was an autocrat, and that he stepped on toes needlessly. He was accused, openly and behind his back, of taking more credit than was really due him for the Renaissance of Savannah. It was said that he hogged the limelight, that he was insincere, and that his only interest in historic preservation was to use it as a means to gain fame and make money. Jim Williams was among those who felt this way about him. Adler and Williams were outwardly civil, but just barely. Adler had been a member of the Telfair Museum's board of directors when Jim Williams was president, and from time to time their animosity spilled out into the open at board meetings. On one occasion, Adler accused Williams of stealing furniture from the museum. Williams denied it, and countercharged that Adler was trying to blacken the name of anyone who had more power over the museum's affairs than he did. Eventually, Williams engineered a plot that forced Adler off the board, and Adler never forgave him. Williams was contemptuous of virtually everything about Lee Adler, his taste in art, his word of honor, even his house. A visitor once rang Williams' doorbell by mistake and asked if Mr. Adler was at home. Williams told the man, "Mr. Adler doesn't live here. He lives in half the double house next door." Lee Adler was no less disparaging of Williams. He believed him to be fundamentally dishonest and said so. Furthermore, he suspected the Nazi flag episode was more than a light-hearted attempt to foil a crew of movie makers. He let it be known that a letter, addressed to Williams from the John Birch Society, had once been delivered to his house. Adler was critical of Jim Williams's decadent lifestyle, but he was just curious enough about it to get out his binoculars and spy on one of Williams's all-male Christmas parties. Adler had clumsily forgotten to turn out the light behind himself and was silhouetted in the window. Williams saw him, waved, and drew his shutters. In spite of all this, there were restraining factors that kept the two men on a civil footing most of the time. Lee Adler was Leopold Adler II, the grandson of the founder of Adler's department store, Savannah's answer to Saks Fifth Avenue, and his mother was a niece of Julius Rosenwald of the Sears Roebuck fortune. Emma Adler was the sole heir to the biggest block of stock in the Savannah Bank. She had been president of the Junior League and was an active member of several civic organizations. So the reality of the situation was that both Jim Williams and the Adlers were prominent, influential, and rich. They lived in such close proximity and moved in so many of the same circles that they felt obliged to remain on cordial terms. Which was why, despite his loathing for them, Jim Williams always invited the Adlers to his Christmas parties. And why, even though they detested Williams in return, the Adlers always accepted. Early one bright April morning, Lee Adler came toward me with a broad smile on his face and an arm outstretched in greeting. "Shake the hand that's going to shake the hand of the Prince of Wales," he said. Mr. Adler was making a jocular reference to an article in the morning paper announcing that he and his wife would be traveling to Washington at the end of the week to meet Prince Charles of England.
the Adlers and the Prince were to participate in a discussion of low-income housing. Adler assumed I had read the article, and of course I had. Most of Savannah had read it, and to judge from Mr. Adler's ebullient mood, he either didn't know or didn't care what certain people were saying about it.
"It's just another of Leopold's cheap self-promotional ploys," Jim Williams said. But the rolling of eyes and clearing of throats was not limited to people who disliked Lee Adler. Catherine Gore, a lifelong friend of the Adlers, also found the news distasteful.
"I'd like to meet Prince Charles, too," she said. "But I'd never stoop so low to do it. Low-income housing, indeed."
Adler and I were standing in Adler's office on the ground floor of his townhouse. This was the command post from which he directed his many projects in real estate and historic preservation. A telephone rang in another room. Somewhere a copy machine churned. The walls of his office were documented with memorabilia of Adler's role in the remarkable renaissance of Savannah's historic district. The photographs documented parallel transformations that had taken place over the past 25 years. Savannah regaining the splendor of its youth, and a youthful Lee Adler progressing by stages into silver-haired middle age. Adler wore half-moon glasses and a pale, rumpled summer suit. His speech was a soft, cajoling drawl. We had met a week earlier at a garden party given by a local historian, and Adler had offered to take me on a tour of Savannah to show me, stage by stage, how Savannah had been saved from the wrecker's ball. As we got into his car, he let me know he was aware of all the carping going on behind his back.
"Do you know what the saying for the day is?" he asked. "It ain't bragging if you really done it."
He gave me a meaningful glance over the top of his glasses, as if to say, "Never mind all the backbiting you've been hearing. It's sour grapes." We pulled away from the curb and began moving through the streets at 10 miles an hour. As we did, the visual treasures of Savannah flowed by in slow motion. Townhouses, mansions, shadowed gardens, well-tended squares.
"Picture all of this deserted and empty," said Adler. "Imagine it run down, windows broken, weatherboards unpainted and rotting, shutters falling off, roofs caving in. Think what the squares would look like if they were nothing but hard-packed dirt instead of grass and azaleas and beautiful landscaping. Because that's the way it used to be. That's why Lady Asta called Savannah a beautiful woman with a dirty face when she came here after the Second World War. That's what Savannah had allowed itself to become. And what's frightening is that while it was happening, nobody gave one goddamn." A truck behind us honked its horn. Adler pulled over to let it pass, then kept moving at a slow pace, continuing the story of Savannah's decline. Until the 1920s, he said, Savannah had remained basically intact, an architecturally exquisite 19th-century town. But the flight to the suburbs was just then beginning. People moved out of the lovely old houses downtown. They cut them into apartments, tore them down, or just boarded them up and left them empty. In those days, all the money was being funneled into the development of the suburbs, which was fortunate for Savannah in one respect. It meant there was no clamor to bulldoze massive areas downtown for housing developments. Nor did Savannah have superhighways slicing through the center of it the way other cities did, because Savannah was not on the way to somewhere else. It was geographically the end of the line. In the mid-1950s, almost a third of the old city was gone. Then, in 1954, the owners of a funeral parlor announced plans to knock down a dilapidated tenement so they could use the space for a parking lot, and a number of concerned citizens rose up in protest. The tenement happened to be Davenport House, one of the finest examples of federal architecture in America. It was a shambles at the time. 11 families were crowded into it. Seven ladies got together, Lee Adler's mother being one of them, and saved Davenport House and restored it. They then formed the Historic Savannah Foundation, and that was the beginning of Savannah's salvation. In the early days, Historic Savannah had a vigilante committee that sounded the alarm when an old house was about to be demolished. But the committee had no power to prevent demolition of houses, or even to gain a stay of execution. All it could do was try to find some sympathetic soul who would buy the endangered building and restore it. Most of the time, the house came down before the committee could find anybody to save it. It soon became clear that the only way to save old houses was to buy them. And that was when Lee Adler became involved.
"I was having breakfast one morning," he said. "It was December of 1959. I read in the newspaper that a row of four townhouses on Oglethorpe Avenue was about to be torn down. They were lovely, built in 1855. They were known as the Mary Marshall Row. It was the same old story. A local wrecker had bought the houses in order to knock them down and sell the bricks. The bricks. You see, they're Savannah gray bricks, which are larger and more porous than ordinary bricks, and they have a very soft and beautiful color. They were kilned at the Hermitage Plantation on the Savannah River. They're not made anymore, and you can't duplicate them. They were selling for 10 cents each at the time, more than three times the cost of an ordinary brick. Anyhow, the wrecker had already demolished the carriage houses, and the townhouses themselves would be gone in a matter of days."
Adler pulled over to the curb on Oglethorpe Avenue, in front of Colonial Cemetery. Across the street stood a handsome row of four brick townhouses, each with a stoop of white marble steps leading up to the main entrance on the second floor. The bricks were a muted grayish red.
"There they are," he said, "fully restored. When I came to look at them that day, the windows were out, the doors were gone, and the steps were in bad shape. The bricks from the carriage houses were piled up in the backyard. I went into one of the houses and climbed up to the third floor and looked out at the magnificent view, and I thought, this can't be allowed to happen."
Adler paid a call on old Mr. Monroe, the wrecker, and told him he wanted to buy the whole row. Mr. Monroe told him he could get the bricks to him in 6 weeks.
"I don't want you to touch those bricks," Adler replied. "I want you to leave them right where they are."
Mr. Monroe agreed, but said Adler would have to buy the land, too. He could have the whole row, bricks and land, for $54,000. So Adler and three other men signed a note for it. Then they wrote a prospectus and took it to Historic Savannah Foundation, which had 300 members at the time, proposing that the foundation buy the row at a cost of $180 a member.
"My idea," said Adler, "was that the foundation would resell the houses to people who would agree to restore them. Historic Savannah went along with it."
That was the beginning of the revolving fund. It happened that the poet Conrad Aiken had lived as a child in the house right next door to Marshall Row, at number 228, the house in which Aiken's father had shot his mother and then himself on that terrible morning in February 1901. Having spent most of his life up north, Aiken wanted to come back and live his last years in Savannah. So a millionaire friend, a man named Hi Soboloff, bought and restored the house on the end of Marshall Row for Aiken and his wife, Mary. It was number 230, the house next door to the one Aiken had lived in as a boy. "When work was completed on the house," said Adler, "the contrast between it and the other three was startling. I went to the phone and called the newspaper and said, 'Do you want to see a miracle? Come on.' So they came over, and they did a big feature on it in their Sunday edition. That was in February 1962. We had an open house the day the story appeared. It rained, but something like 7,000 people came through the house. They wore the shellac off the banister.
We let them go into the unrestored house next door, too, for a before and after comparison. And they saw for the first time how a dilapidated wreck could be transformed into something marvelous. When that happened, we started to get some interest. People began to see the potential. They began to think about moving back downtown. Of course, it didn't hurt one bit that Savannah's greatest man of letters, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, was leading the way. We resumed our drive. Adler pointed out dozens of houses that had been saved, describing in detail their once fallen condition. The porch on that one was completely gone. That house had bright green asbestos siding and aluminum awnings. The roof on that one was rotted through. He was like a doctor reviewing the case histories of former patients now fully recovered. Adler's success with Marshall Rowe encouraged him to go out and raise money for a revolving fund to be used by Historic Savannah to save other houses in the same way. The concept was very simple. Historic Savannah would use the money to buy endangered houses, then resell them, at a loss if necessary, to people who would sign a pledge to begin restoration within 18 months. The foundation set a goal of $200,000 for the fund, enough money in those days to save a lot of houses if they were turned over quickly enough. And they were. But even with the revolving fund, it was a struggle, said Adler. I'd come downtown every day and breathe in the air and plot out the day's fight. And it was indeed a fight, because the buildings were still coming down pretty fast. Sometimes we won, sometimes we lost. And the voters of Savannah gave us no help at all. They rejected urban renewal 3 times because they thought it was a communist plot, and they defeated any number of proposals for historic zoning ordinances. That monstrosity over there, for instance, was one of our biggest losses. The Hyatt Regency Hotel. We were riding along Bay Street, passing in front of the Hyatt, a squat, modernist building next to City Hall. The Hyatt had been a great cause célèbre in Savannah. The building had taken a great chunk out of the row of 19th-century cotton warehouses along Factor's Walk, and its backside jutted out over River Street, interrupting the line of facades along the riverfront. The public battle over the hotel delayed its construction for 10 years. "You can see the hotel is all wrong for the site," said Adler. "We fought it in the courts, and let me tell you, it was a bruising battle. Both of the developers were members of Historic Savannah Foundation. The sister of one of them was the acting director. The organization was split right down the middle, practically destroyed. It was a very emotional time. I remember going to a wedding while all that was happening, and when I walked in, I realized I was suing everybody in the room but the bride and the minister." At about that time, restoration of the historic district was nearing completion. Over 1,000 houses had been restored. The work had been done by affluent whites, but Adler insisted that blacks had not been displaced. Historic Savannah was buying empty buildings for the most part. But when the supply of unrestored houses in the historic district began to dwindle, the next logical step was to restore the houses in the neighboring Victorian district. And that would have been a different story. We drove south on Abercorn Street. Within a few blocks, the restrained architecture of the historic district gave way to the late Victorian flights of fancy, big old wooden houses with romantic towers, gables, and elaborate gingerbread trim. A few were restored, but most were in very poor condition. The Victorian district was Savannah's first streetcar suburb. It had been built for the white working class between 1870 and 1910. After World War II, when the whites moved farther out into the suburbs, absentee landlords took over, and by 1975, the area had become a black slum. The houses were in deplorable shape, but they were still beautiful, and in recent years, speculators and upper-income whites started buying them. At that point, Adler became alarmed. It would have meant gentrification and massive displacement of blacks, he said, and I was determined to prevent that. I asked Historic Savannah to help find a way to restore this area without evicting the people who lived here, but Historic Savannah was still busted up over the Hyatt, and they weren't interested in the housing problems of poor people. That's when I quit Historic Savannah. I launched a non-profit organization called the Savannah Landmark Rehabilitation Project, which has been a triumph, because the board includes everybody. Black, white, you name it, rich and poor. Adler's intention was to get houses out of the hands of the absentee slumlords and convert the Victorian district into a racially and economically diverse neighborhood. It occurred to him that the project might qualify for public assistance, and thus far, by using a combination of public and private funding, he had bought and renovated 300 units. Tenants paid 30% of their income in rent, and the rest was made up by federal rent subsidies. I don't suppose I need to tell you, Adler said, that not everyone is happy about what we're doing here. Some people complain privately about poor blacks living in subsidized housing so close to the historic district. A few people, like Jim Williams, have even spoken out publicly about it. Jim Williams says we're dealing with the criminal element. I take it you've heard of Jim Williams? Yes, I said, I've met him. Do you know about the Nazi flag incident? He told me about it, I said. He said he draped it over his balcony to interrupt a film being shot in Monterey Square. That's right, said Adler. He had all those little faggots hanging the swastika out there and moving it from window to window. On Anderson Street, Adler stopped in front of a freshly painted gray and white house. Now I'm going to introduce you to an example of our so-called criminal element. We climbed the steps, and Adler rang the bell. A black woman in a flowered house dress came to the door. "Morning, Ruby," said Adler.
"Morning, Mr. Adler," she said.
Adler introduced me to Mrs. Ruby Moore.
"Ruby, I brought this gentleman to see what life is like in the Victorian district, if you don't mind." "Oh, that'll be fine," she said pleasantly. "Come on in."
Ruby Moore's duplex was cool inside. It had three bedrooms, a modern kitchen, and high ceilings. There was a small garden in back. A portrait of John F. Kennedy hung over the living room mantel. Adler led me on a quick tour, upstairs and down. Then we rejoined Mrs. Moore in the front hall. "These houses was pitiful before they was fixed over," she said. "I never dreamed they'd look like this after they got through. While they was redoing them, I was over here every day looking, 'cause I knew I was going to get one. I really do appreciate my apartment, I really do. It's got central heat and air."
"Is everything okay, Ruby?" Adler asked.
"Oh, yes," she said.
Then she turned to me.
"Would you sign my book, please?"
A guest book lay open on a table in the living room. As I signed my name, I noticed that I was not the first outsider to be brought to this house by Lee Adler. A reporter from the Atlanta Constitution had signed a few spaces above. We got back in the car. Adler told me that Ruby Moore qualified for one of his apartments because she was a longtime resident of the Victorian district, because she worked, she was a housekeeper at the Days Inn, and because her income was below a specified level. She paid $250 a month in rent, and federal subsidies covered the rest. Adler said that Mrs. Moore more than satisfied his inspection staff. Her house was always immaculate, and she was the rule, rather than the exception.
"We're not interested in housing the whores or the gamblers or the dope dealers," he said.
We headed back into the historic district.
"I could show you another 100 apartments just like that one, but you probably get the picture.
Once we got going, private investors started buying houses and property values began to rise. The Victorian district has been acclaimed as a national model for how to restore inner cities without uprooting the poor. We sponsored a national housing conference here in 1977, and 400 people came from 38 states. The next year, Rosalind Carter came down and taped a segment of Good Morning America in one of our renovated apartments. And this Friday, we're going to Washington to explain it all to Prince Charles. We entered Monterey Square and swung around it counterclockwise, coming to a stop in front of Adler's house.
"Well, there you have it," he said. "Historic preservation used to be an elitist hobby, something rich dilettantes dabbled in. But we've turned it into a grassroots operation. In the process, we created a $200 million tourist industry and brought people back downtown to live. Not bad, huh?"
"Quite an accomplishment," I said. Adler looked at me over the top of his half-moon glasses. "It ain't bragging if you really done it." A week later, the Savannah Morning News published an account of the Adler's meeting with Prince Charles. Lee Adler was quoted as saying that the prince showed a keen interest in the problems of cities. Emma Adler said the prince had asked marvelously intelligent, wonderful, and apt questions. 4 days later, the newspaper ran yet another article about the meeting, this one a first-person account written by Mrs. Adler. "It was a heavenly day in Washington," she wrote. "The sun was bright, the sky a deep blue. The weather was perfect for a suit." Once again, the Adlers were the topic of conversation in certain circles. The talk was nowhere more animated than at the meeting of the Married Woman's Card Club on Tuesday night.
"Do you suppose," said a woman in a blue taffeta dress, "that the newspaper had to twist Emma's arm to get her to write that article? Or do you think Emma twisted the newspaper's arm to make them print it?"
The woman's dress had a bow across the shoulders as big as wings.
"Julia, you're wicked," said a woman wearing a black velvet headband and single pearl earrings. "No, I'm not," the woman in blue replied. "The Adlers could have kept their audience with Prince Charles a private matter if they'd wanted to, but they've gone running to the newspaper as usual, and that changes things."
"True.
I mean, Emma could have restrained herself a little, don't you think? She sounded so prissy and pleased with herself."
"Now, Julia," said the other woman, her voice dropping in volume, "I do believe you're jealous."
The two ladies had not yet begun to play cards. In fact, they were still standing outside Cynthia Collins' front door, waiting to be admitted. That was one of the unusual rituals of the Married Woman's Card Club. Married Woman's, as it was known for short, was one of Savannah's most exclusive societies. No other city had anything like it. It was founded in 1893 by 16 ladies in search of amusement during the day while their husbands were at work. There were always 16 members, no more, no less. Once a month, always on a Tuesday, they would gather at one of the members' homes for 2 hours of card playing, cocktails, and a light supper. 32 guests would be invited by engraved invitation, so that the number of ladies in attendance always came to 48. 12 card tables in all. According to custom, the ladies would arrive a few minutes before 4 in the afternoon, wearing white gloves, long dresses, and huge hats adorned with flowers or feathers. They didn't ring the doorbell. Instead, they waited outside, either in their cars or on the sidewalk, until the hostess opened the door punctually at 4 o'clock. The ladies would then enter, sit down at the card tables, and start playing at once. In the early years, they played whist or euchre or 500. Later, the game became auction bridge, then contract bridge. But for many years, there was always one table of whist, because Mrs. J.J. Rowers refused to learn how to play anything else. Once the ladies had begun playing, events proceeded according to a strict schedule that began with the serving of a glass of water. Every member was given a printed copy of the schedule upon joining Married Woman's. It read as follows. 4:15, water. 4:30, remove water. 4:40, empty ashtrays. 4:45, pass napkins. 5 o'clock, cocktails. 5:15, second cocktail. 5:30, third cocktail. 5:35, last hand, pass linen. 5:40, serve dinner plates. 5:45, high score and cut for aces. 6 o'clock, prizes. Ladies leave promptly. Being the hostess at one of these affairs was a serious matter. It was viewed as reason enough to paint the house or redecorate the parlor. At the very least, one took the silver out of the vault. As for keeping to the printed schedule, there was always a cadre of maids who knew the sequence of events better than the members did, and they would be loaned to nervous hostesses in order to ease their burden. The importance of the schedule was that it enabled the married women to get home in time to greet their husbands when they returned from work. Husbands were as much a part of Married Woman's as their wives. They were, after all, the ones who footed the bill for the dinners and for refurbishing the house beforehand. And they were, of course, the major qualification for membership. A woman had to be married to belong. The rules stated that if a member obtained a divorce, she would be forced to resign and forfeit her dues. More than one marriage had been held together by that rule alone. In any case, 3 times a year, the hour for Married Woman's was moved from 4 to 7:30, so that the all-important husbands could attend. The men would wear black tie. On the Tuesday following the Adlers' return from Washington, husbands were invited to Married Woman's. Mrs. Cameron Collins was the hostess for the evening. She and her husband lived with their 3 children in a townhouse on Oglethorpe Avenue. Men in black tie and women in long dresses began milling around in front of the house shortly before 7:30. I, too, had put on a black tie that evening, having been invited by Mrs. Collins. "I am not jealous of Emma Adler," said the woman in blue. "Not at all. I'd be the first to admit that Emma does a great many worthwhile things. She's an asset to the community. And if anybody deserves to meet Prince Charles, she does. It's just this grasping for recognition. It's so undignified. They always do it. You'd think Lee restored Savannah single-handedly. Lee loves basking in the limelight, and so does Emma." The woman turned to a man with thinning blonde hair, who was leaning casually against a tree with his hands in his pockets. "Darling," she said, "do you think I'm being unfair?" The man shrugged. "If you ask me, Emma Adler is a vast improvement over her mother." Emma Adler's mother was Emma Waltower Morell, a large and domineering woman known around town as Big Emma. Big Emma was one of the richest people in Savannah, being the largest stockholder in the Savannah Bank, and she had a forceful personality. As one family friend put it, Big Emma was the sort of person who wasn't happy unless she had a table to pound on. Stories about her had become legend in Savannah. At home, she kept a padlock on the refrigerator to keep the help from stealing the food. She would get up from the table 10 or 15 times in the course of a dinner party to go into the kitchen and unlock and relock the refrigerator. Later on, after the guests had left, John Morell would slip into the kitchen and tip the help generously in an effort to soothe feelings bruised from an evening of Big Emma's abuse. Well into her 90s, Big Emma could still be seen driving around Savannah at the wheel of her Mercedes limousine,
with her German shepherd sitting next to her on the front seat, and an ancient black chauffeur, dressed in full livery, sitting in back. The chauffeur